This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, so let's dive right into our Week in Review. Big changes in the works this week. Boston City Councilors Michelle Wu and Anissa Asaibi George feel the heat as they try to change their title to mayor.
This is not what I wanted this mayoral race to turn into, and this is what I have tried to ensure that we stay focused on the issues.
Okay, we're going to hold it right here.
This is important work, Michelle, to lead this city, and the people of Boston deserve honesty. They deserve clarity.
Sound from a debate on NBC 10 earlier this week there. Families prepare for their kids to be safely vaccinated finally after 20 months of waiting.
We have secured vaccine supply to vaccinate every child ages 5 through 11.
I think this is a big win for the American people.
That's Jeff Zients, head of President Biden's COVID task force, and Dr. Ofer Levy, member of the FDA Vaccine Advisory Committee, speaking there. Meanwhile, acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey decides she has to change the city's approach at Mass and Cass.
Tents and temporary shelters will no longer be permitted in the city of Boston.
It's a big step, but the situation has become truly a humanitarian crisis.
I ran across a woman who comes down at least three times a week and just drops off food. She opens the back of her van and yells, "Food!"
WBUR's Deb Becker reporting to us there. We are going to review all of it, and let's start there at Mass and Cass with the situation around the neighborhood there. Did the acting mayor do the right thing for public safety, or will this criminalize homelessness and addiction? Will people want to go into treatment and shelter, and if not, what happens to them if the tents aren't allowed there anymore as long as there's a bed available? How do we get here? And should we have acted sooner? Should she have acted sooner? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Also here to join the conversation, Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, and Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and writer. Marie Frances, thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
And Ed, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be back.
Okay, I'm going to start right away with some sound from Acting Mayor Kim Janey unveiling her executive order, which, among other things, eliminates the tents and temporary shelters.
With a focus on public health, the executive order will establish a central coordinating team made up of city and state partners who will identify shelter and treatment options available through the region, as tents and temporary shelters will no longer be permitted in the city of Boston.
And I do want to clarify there, the mayor went on to say that one could not be forced from a tent if there wasn't a bed or a shelter place to go to. So I think that's a important caveat. But still, how do we even talk about this executive order, Ed and Marie Frances, without asking like 100 questions at once? Right thing, right time, enough, why now, what's next? What does it mean for the next mayor? Marie Frances, what is your reaction to this executive order?
I mean, it's heartbreaking what's happening down at Mass and Cass, has been happening for a long time. And bottom line is that everybody deserves safety, and safety is affordable housing. Safety is access to critical services. We see this happening in Boston. We see this happening across Massachusetts. We see it happening, frankly, across the country, and it's been worsened by COVID-19. And we have to come to terms with poverty. What we're seeing is poverty. And it's a human-made problem, and that these folks have been failed by our housing systems. They've been failed by our public health systems. They've been failed by our criminal legal systems. And we absolutely cannot, and we see faith leaders, public health experts say, we can't criminalize folks who are suffering from substance abuse disorders and don't have access to housing. So number one is, let's make sure that there are not any sweeps, because we've seen it happen before, right? And that we need to create a harm reduction plan that really centers the people who are experiencing homelessness down there, and to also have the money to be able to support city services and state-run services to help these people over the long term.
So, Ed, I'm going to play a little more sound here. As part of her executive order, Acting Mayor Janey's administration officially declared the situation a public health crisis.
Thus, the commission has declared substance use disorder, unsheltered homelessness, and related issues in the city of Boston a public health crisis.
As we think about that, Ed, we know there are a number of reasons that people don't want to go into shelter. If they go into shelter, then there are questions of their safe spaces, their belongings, whether or not they've been traumatized in spaces before, et cetera. So how is it going to work, this public health crisis, addressing this public health crisis by moving people out of tents without increasing trauma and potentially some criminalization, as Marie Francis said?
I think if you're addicted to opiates, you're never safe. Those tents on the street are not safe. But we keep hearing that there are treatment beds available and shelter beds available in greater number than the number of tents available there. We used to call it methadone mile to remind us why this happened, how we've institutionalized the problem rather than solving it, like Skid Row in L.A. or the downtown homeless problem in San Francisco. This is not working. The people that are living there are not getting better, and it's growing. It's a huge number of people. It's not improving. The logic that led to required vaccinations and masking needs to be applied to this public health crisis also, which is that individual autonomy is not as important as ending the human suffering, or at least reducing the human suffering. I agree. There's been failures in housing and treatment and many, many things, but this is not working. And I'm glad Mayor Janey is moving away from this, though it's not a coincidence she acted after she lost a preliminary election. Politics has been the problem with this issue for years.
So a couple things there. When, you know, part of the reason we don't call it methadone mile anymore, part of the reason that Skid Row isn't often the term used anymore, is to keep from pathologizing people who haven't had the supports that they need to work their way out of this. And Ed, I want to pick up on the second part of what you said, because both mayoral candidates this week had a response to this. And I want to play a little bit of Anissa Asaibi-George here, who said that not only does she approve of these moves, but they were her plan. So here she is at our town hall last night responding to me. I'm the one talking to her.
Day one of my administration, I can continue that work in a more meaningful way.
Do you think she literally picked up on your plan? And did you talk to her between when your plan came out on Sunday and when the acting mayor made her executive order on Tuesday?
Yes.
Which part?
All of it.
So then Boston mayoral candidate Michelle Wu also had positive comments about this earlier this week in the NBC 10 debate. She talks about hiring a cabinet-level official to deal specifically with the issue.
I stand in support of the leadership here to declare this a crisis in our communities, and I'm going to go even further. One of my first hires will be a cabinet-level chief of Mass and Cass, overseeing this new command structure and ensuring in reporting directly to me that there's accountability and leadership in coordinating our efforts.
So, Marie Francis, I wanted to get both of those voices in because it does raise a question. It was exactly 2 weeks before a mayoral election when Mayor Janey did this, but this has been a problem for a long time. 2 weeks after that election, there will be a new mayor. So why does acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey do this 4 weeks before someone else will be in charge? What do you think is going on there?
Firstly, winter's coming. It's going to be cold soon, so it just makes sense to try and figure out a plan that is people-centered. And, you know, and it's important to bring up the conversation now. I mean, voters have, less than 2 weeks to make a decision on who they're going to vote for to be the next mayor of Boston. And I think it's an important time to elevate this issue.
So I want to think about one other part of this, too. And again, we've just had a lot of amazing sound this week from this story. Here is WBUR's Deb Becker, who did some reporting from Mass and Cass on the day after the executive order. And she talked with us about a chilling scene that she witnessed while walking the neighborhood with an activist.
You know, we came across a woman who was it was awful. I mean, she was passed out on the sidewalk and didn't appear to be breathing well, and he was trying to help her. He did get her upright, and she became very agitated and told him to leave her alone, and she eventually just walked away. And I don't know what happened to her.
So, Ed, that is the opposite of the bystander who ignores what they see, right? This activist tried to do something. And I think about the scale of this problem, the fact that we know for a fact many of the people who have found themselves there come from other parts of the Commonwealth, where we're not seeing coordinated response and where we're seeing pushback as the city of Boston tries to get a regional coordinated response. How do you get past that pushback? And I guess, you know, is there a role for the governor to play in this?
It comes down to incentives. The reason why people are traveling great distances to get there is because they know that there are incentives there that are not available elsewhere. I don't think this is about the number of treatment programs that are available. They've realized they can go somewhere and stay there and not face the hard choices. You know, I think I'm not pathologizing people that are there that suffer from addiction. It's a medical condition. It's what are we doing? You know, a lot of people, I'm one of them, have had people in our lives over the years that had addictions and mental illness, and we ended up enabling it year after year when we really should have stopped enabling it and really made them make decisions. I think the city and the state have to decide to stop enabling what is happening there in the name of compassion, in the name of how these people are suffering. Something special is happening there that is sucking people in, and we have to change the incentives of going there. I do think it's regional. It's not about the city of Boston entirely. The state should get involved. I assume the state is involved in some way, but ultimately it's Mayor Janey's call to decide how she's going to manage the on-the-street situation. Even the people feeding them, I believe in feeding the poor. But again, these people are all enabling them to stay there by giving them what they need, and they're not getting better. I think there are hard choices to be made, and I want to see Mayor Janey and then Michelle Wu make those choices.
So Ed has put a stake in the ground about who he thinks is going to win, I think, there in the mayoral election. We only have a little bit of time left before I want to take a quick break and shift gears, Marie Francis. But I do want to ask pointedly the responsibility of Quincy in this, because they are the key to a Long Island bridge that could restore services on Long Island.
Yes, I agree with Ed on one point, is that elected leaders, and whether it's city and town officials or on the state level, need to do something. One thing that really stuck with me as I was, you know, looking at all the coverage and listening to the stories on this is people saying that whether it's in Quincy, whether it's in Everett, where there were plans to perhaps have some housing in Everett, the services are, you know, and I'm quoting somebody on this, are grossly underfunded. So we need to put our money where our mouths are as well in terms of making sure that folks have stable and supportive housing and services that they need.
So I think you might be talking about Revere and that proposal for the 35.
Yes.
Yeah, Quality Inn and Revere.
Me.
No,
Revere.
That's fine. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to still with us, Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and writer, and Marie Francis Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. Join the conversation. We want to know, are you boosted? Are you going to get boosted? Are you doing the mix and match now? Maybe you're not yet vaccinated. Why? Ready to move on from the whole thing? And a little bit later, with an election a little more than a week away, are you voting in your city and town? Election day? Early? Undecided still? We'll talk about all of it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ed, how big of a deal is it for our public health to have the level of booster rollout that we are at now? Just to be clear, all three brands qualify for a booster with certain populations. With J&J, everyone over 18 who got it more than 2 months ago. Now mixing and matching allowed. Did you ever think we'd get here?
Yes, I was confident that boosters would be necessary at some point. It's welcome, though, because it hopefully will smooth out our exit from COVID as the size of the public health threat that it poses. I do feel that the rest of the world needs to get vaccinated, and I wonder how many Americans will get a shot when there are more needy arms in the developing world. So I do have qualms about that, but I do hope that those who are vulnerable, who need a booster shot, actually get it, and I hope that those who don't need it maybe don't get it in favor of someone else getting it.
So there's another thing that's been on my mind, Marie Francis, which is sort of self-inflicted wounds in the public health messaging. Here's an example. So first, the J&J vaccine, it's get it. And they're all just as good. Then it's, well, the most important thing is to get a vaccine. So if that's the one available, get it. Then, well, maybe it should have been two doses. It's a little less effective. Then every single person who got it needs another shot after at least 2 months. And then, in fact, you're probably better off getting a different shot, right? So is that unavoidable given the rapid changing nature of this pandemic? Or are those self-inflicted wounds that confuse and frustrate people in public health messaging?
So, I mean, I think we've been in this uncertainty for feels like eons at this point, but almost 2 years. And, you know, I think the message is clear. Number one, you should be vaccinated. Also the messaging follow up, and similar to what Ed said, is walk, don't run to get a booster shot. So I think we also have to give some grace to you know, the public health experts who are all trying to figure this out in real time. But I'm hopeful and I'm excited about the potential vaccine rollout for young folks.
So actually, all right, let's talk a little bit about that. So here is Jeff Zients, head of President Biden's COVID task force, says the federal government has 28 million doses ready to go as soon as vaccines for children age 5 to 11 are authorized.
We have secured vaccine supply to vaccinate every child ages 5 through 11. And as soon as the vaccine is authorized by the FDA, we will begin shipping millions of doses nationwide.
So, Ed, to your point a minute ago, and I've been thinking also a lot about this, we have 28 million doses ready ahead of time on something that 20 months ago, well, we know from previous interviews that about 22 months ago, they were just beginning to sequence this thing, right? And now we are ready to vaccinate one of the last remaining groups of people who hadn't yet qualified. I wonder sometimes, too, if we're not taking enough time to marvel at the sheer will and innovation that has gotten us to this part of this pandemic.
We haven't, but it's hard to marvel during a pandemic. But you are absolutely correct that the idea of getting a vaccine out this fast is historically unprecedented. People would have said it was impossible even 4 or 5 years ago that this could be done. So I think that if, as you had implied, that if this was the traditional vaccine rollout, none of these problems would happen because people could have waited for the data. I still think it's miraculous. I continue to think it's miraculous, and I'm trying not to be impatient based on how they've done it. But I'm very much looking forward to the 5 to 11 rollout, as I have three of my children are 5 to 11, so I'm looking forward to that.
You'll be in line?
We'll all be in line, yes.
Fantastic. All right, I wanted to grab a couple of calls here. First is Tom in Acton. Tom, go ahead.
Hi.
Go ahead, Tom. Hi.
Just kind of giving a perspective, I got my booster, but I would also highly recommend everybody else get their own boosters. You know, I work in the hospital, and we actually having difficulty shipping, taking care of patients in the ICU because numbers are so high that we actually have to get to the point where we have to ship patients out of state because all the patients in the ICU, anyone who has COVID, are usually the people who are not vaccinated. So that was just...
Thank you. Thanks for sharing that perspective, Tom. And I do want to pick up Paul in Marshfield as well. Paul, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. I got my Johnson & Johnson in April 7th of this year, but I'm wondering with the new information, can I just go to Walgreens and get like a two-shot thing of Moderna?
So this is not Ask the Doctors, Paul, but because yours was April 7th, I got the Johnson & Johnson on April 10th, as it happens. So we are kindred spirits in this. The new guidance does allow for you to get a Moderna or Pfizer booster. As I understand it, and this is, as I understand it, it will not be a two-shot course. It is a single shot of one of the mRNAs, but the CDC has allowed for anybody after 2 months of the J&J shot over the age of 18, it does allow you to get an mRNA, which is Moderna or Pfizer booster. All right, so actually, there's a lot I want to make sure that we get to. We've done a little bit of COVID here. We've done the boosters. We've done the kids. I do want to spend a minute on the mayor's race. And Marie Francis, I'm going to note something that was interesting. We did these two town halls this week at WBUR with counselors Anissa Asaibi-George and Michelle Wu. In fact, we're going to have an excerpt from Asaibi-George later in the show. We took audience questions. We got some 40 questions per town hall submitted. Some of them were duplicates. But what struck me was in all of that, there was one question about COVID, Marie Francis, which would have boggled the mind 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. Is the city of Boston looking forward now in this mayor's race?
I think it is. I mean, firstly, we want to commend just the tremendous efforts that councilors Anissa Asaibi-George and Michelle Wu to try to represent this beautiful and diverse city. That's interesting that you only got one question about COVID. I sometimes think it's such part of our lives that sometimes we forget it exists until it's really in our faces again. But I mean, I just commend also what you've done, what WBUR has done. I think part of the richness of this race and has been just the conversations that we've had, the community forums, the televised forums, and all of the connections that we've made throughout many, many months together. And that in and of itself has just been pretty transformational.
I want to pick up on that. I had some different sound I was going to play, but I want to pick up on that, Marie Frances, because I recall a moment on Monday night talking with Michelle Wu where she talked about the many, many, many public forums that all of the candidates participated in. And you could hear, Ed, both the fatigue in her voice and kind of the awe and respect of the fact that there's been that much public conversation. And then we heard Anissa Esaibi-George last night talk over and over again about the importance of being in dialogue with the voters in the city. So I guess my question to you, Ed, is have we seen a different approach with these candidates? And is there a dialogue on the issues going on with community leaders, with voters, with people on the street that feels different?
Well, I mean, the race isn't competitive at all. I mean, Michelle Wu has been up by 30 points or more in among polling shops that don't make those kinds of mistakes. So she'll be mayor no matter what happens. But I do think that the debate has been good. A lot of forums, great coverage, media organizations looking for the issues, listening to various communities, all different aspects of the candidates and their lives. I think it has been really great, the debate. I think it's very, very good for the city. I don't think these two women would be very different as mayor. I do think the debate has been great.
So I also want to pick up on that, Ed. So now I am going to play two pieces of sound. First, Michelle Wu from the second mayoral debate responding to Anissa Esaibi-George's claim that Wu is copying ideas from her campaign, amongst some other claims.
The city of Boston deserves better. Our country and our democracy barely survived 4 years of Trump and the types of campaigning that involve negative attacks, personal attacks, falsehoods, and fear-mongering. This is not what I wanted this mayoral race to turn into, and this is what I have tried to ensure that we stay focused on the issues.
And then last night, I want to put next to that Anissa Esaibi-George, a final question that I asked her, what is in your heart?
The city is in my heart. The city's people are in my heart. The city's kids are in my heart. And I worry about them, and I want to do this work for them. I want to lead this city in partnership with them every single day.
So, Marie Frances, two edges of a blade there. One, two candidates speaking passionately about what they think the city deserves. And two, a hint of the fight that has emerged between two candidates that many have said are not that different in policy positions. Is that just what I've read a race forces? Is those that daylight? And your comments on those?
Well, I feel like this is the beauty of female leadership, that we want to be in dialogue with people. We want to be part of the community and be a leader with the community. I don't agree that they're how they would run the city or their policy positions are the same. They, in my estimation, are quite different in terms of public safety, in terms of modernizing our infrastructure.
And we should note, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Yes. I should have noted that you personally are supporting Wu in the race.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry,
yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. But in terms of the plans, if you look at them black and white, there are differences there. So we shouldn't, sweep that under the rug. But yes, I think it's been a pretty stand-up race for the most part, and it's getting down to the wire, and it's typical as a political race comes so close that there, are some words exchanged. So,
and Ed, you've made it pretty clear where you think this is going to come out. Just very briefly, because, well, you know what? Actually, I want to move us on to our hubbubs here, and I'm not supposed to do that, right? It's not good hosting to start the middle of a sentence on a subject and say, I am going to change a subject in the middle of my sentence. But I get to do that. And we have some fun hubbubs today. So actually, let's call it there. We're going to do more again on the mayoral race after the break. Let's do those hubbubs. And Marie Frances, I was just talking to you, so you go.
I'm very excited. The Boston Globe just started the Black News Hour. It's run by Black journalists. Janae Osterhelt and Megan Irons are, I think, the two leading hosts. And it's just looking into, expanding the dialogue on issues in the Black community here in Boston.
Two fantastic minds, both people that we have sometimes here on Radio Boston. Great hubbub. Thank you. Ed, you brought one, too.
Yes, so it came out a couple of days ago that our Massachusetts Department of Transportation, looking at traffic patterns, has noticed that a lot of drivers are shifting to a Tuesday to Thursday in-person work week, and traffic is much different on the middle of the week than it is on Mondays and Fridays. I drove into the city this morning and there was almost no traffic. I think it's fascinating to discover that maybe the post-COVID world will have a very different commuting schedule. And I think that will really alter people's lives if that sticks. I thought that was fascinating.
I actually think it is fascinating. Rarely do we get to sort of see a social experiment play out because of exogenous conditions, Ed. And it is interesting to now see sort of what we would have wondered and had no way to know. And obviously, we had an awful way to find out. But it is fascinating to see that now. Okay, so my hubbub. We cannot go into Friday without a moment to acknowledge what in the sports world is known as the thrill of victory.
Schwarber hits it a ton into right. At the wall. Another grand slam.
And then the agony of defeat.
And now Jason Castro, the Astros' final hope here in the top of the ninth. And that's lifted in the short right center for a base hit. Correa around third. He will score. Gurriel on his way to third. He's in safely. Jason Castro comes through.
Oh, my God. I hate that so much. So a painful week of ups and downs in the American League Championship Series. Sox versus Astros. The Sox win two huge games and then are just dusted by the Astros twice, sound there from games 3 and 4. So listen, game 6 is in Houston tonight, and either the Sox win or they are done for the season. Game time is 8:08 p.m. It will be an interesting one to watch, and don't lose hope because Nathan Eovaldi pitches for the Sox tonight, and he has shown up when necessary. So it should be a lot of fun. All right. That is everybody's hubbubs. Marie Frances Rivera, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, thank you for being with us this week.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And Ed Lyons, Massachusetts Republican activist and writer. Great to have you as always. Thanks, Ed.
You're welcome.
And finally today, we want to bring you some of a conversation with Boston City Councilor and mayoral candidate Anissa Seibe-George. Last night at WBUR City Space, I hosted the second in our series of conversations with the final two candidates. Michelle Wu was Monday. You can find that conversation on our website. Now, if you are a regular Radio Boston listener, you already know that if Seibe-George is elected November 1st, she will be the first of many Boston mayoral things, elected woman, mother, person of color. That is also true for Wu. These intersecting identities have been a really key focus in the race between these two very accomplished women. And as such, we began last night's conversation with Seibe-George with the same question that we asked Michelle Wu. Who does she see herself as? Who does she tell herself she is? And how does that impact this important race?
It is significant to me in, I think, a different way than the public sees it. And I appreciate how important this election is to people who don't see a reflection of themselves generally in leadership and certainly not in the mayor's office. To me, it's much more personal, and it goes to my dad. You know, I have always had an interest in municipal government since I was a young girl, since I was a teenager. I was a little bit of a student activist during my high school years growing up here in Boston, and became engaged in and involved in my student council at my high school, Boston Tech. I like to, is this streaming anywhere? We're looking, is there a camera?
Streaming.
Okay, go Tech Tigers. I like to say that out loud, which is now the O'Brien. And I found, I think for myself, a passion in leadership, in activism, in standing up for things that I thought were wrong or heading in the wrong direction or not being paid attention to in the way that they should. So I had this moment in time that my mother actually remembers much clearer than I do. We were at a big meeting around budget cuts around my school. Lots of people there. My mother says it was close to 5,000 people there. That might have been the rally, so she might be conflating two different things. But I remember we had a school community meeting with then Mayor Flynn, students, parents, and they were talking very specifically about budget cuts. And I said something to the effect of, you know, this is crazy. Like, government's supposed to work for the people. City Hall is supposed to work for the people and the kids. And I was a student activist. And went home and told my father, I'm going to run for mayor someday. And he said to me very plainly, an Arab girl with an Arab name will win nothing in this city. And so I have internalized that most of my life. And I appreciate the experiences my dad had in particular immigrating to this country as an Arab, as a Muslim, as a foreigner, trying to find his way both with my mother and my grandparents, but also within community, but then also within the wider world. And I'd say, because we are here on BU's campus, because we are on Comm Ave, how important Boston University was to him and to me. My father was a security guard at BU, and I think it was when he arrived here to work at BU that he met so many different people, and he just really loved being here. Anyway, I digress. So I have always seen this as an opportunity for myself, and I feel in many ways I'm fulfilling that promise I made, maybe to Ray Flynn, Mayor Flynn, Ambassador Flynn, to responding to the challenge that my father made to me. But also, as I got older, as I had real life experiences, as I, you know, went to college and eventually went to the workplace and eventually started teaching, that I saw, wow, like there are important voices and experiences and things that are missing in local government, municipal government. And that's when I decided to run the first time for city councilor at large, because there were those experiences. And I think a lot about being a mother. I think a lot about being a business owner. I think a lot about being a teacher. And I believe that it's my experience in the classroom that has brought me to this moment, because what we do in our schools impacts so many people. So when I think about, I think I've gone off a little bit here, but when I think about who I am, when I think about what makes me tick and what my passion is, it's a couple of things. It's the city. It is the opportunity that Boston has given to me and given to my family, although not all of it was wonderful. Not all of it was sunshine and roses. And I believe that Boston is the center of the world. It's the center of the universe. It is a championship city that still has some failings. I experienced them firsthand, especially as a young kid. I know that my parents experienced them as immigrants, especially my dad. I experienced them today, for sure. But it is still the most fantastic place. And I want, and I talk about it on the campaign trail a little bit. I refer to, you know, we talk a lot about the American dream, especially being a daughter of immigrants, the American dream. I talk about, and I find myself reflecting on the promise of Boston. So Boston's promise, what it meant to my family, my mother, when she immigrated here as a little girl, my father as a young man, and then building a family here in the city. And I feel that I am the fulfillment of the Boston promise. What it means to so many people, what it means to so many residents, whether they're born and raised, and we can talk a lot about that because that's been in the news a lot lately, whether they immigrated as my parents did many years ago, 47 years ago and plus for my mother, or they just arrived. I met a young man out here during the standout who just, you know, he's here for school. And Boston should fulfill that promise to everybody along that spectrum, whether they live their entire life here or just a moment.
So what is one way that the city failed you as a kid that makes you say never again?
I think that the city should never let down. Well, I think sometimes about school. I think about the academic failings that we've had as a district. And I went from Catholic grammar school to public high school, and both, I had some challenges in both. And although high school for me, especially because of the, I think the high school I went to, Boston Tech, go Tech Ties, it was a place that I felt so at home because of the diversity in my school, because I met kids who came from all over the city, because I met kids from different ethnic backgrounds, certainly racial backgrounds, religious backgrounds, which I went to a Catholic grammar school, so there wasn't that diversity in high school, in grammar school, the way there was at my high school. And I also felt at that moment I was able to find my voice. I still struggled academically after I graduated from high school and went on to college. I think that although I was a good student, college was a struggle for me. And I worry about our kids that we don't fully prepare for college and for work and for life. So I think, and I don't want to say that the city failed me. There are weaknesses in our system as a city. And I know with all of the opportunity I had, if there were weaknesses I experienced, that there were failings for other young people. There were failings for other families. You know, and I think about them in my work every single day. And every day I am committed to doing more and doing better, so that if there was a weakness for me and a failing for somebody else, that we're improving the system along the way.
I miss my mom. Mm-hmm. I miss her a lot. And one of the things we used to do, sometimes I would just get a chance to do something cool right, or that I never thought I would do, and I would call her, and we would go, right? That was one of the things I would do with my mom. I've been thinking a lot about your father.
Mm-hmm. You make me cry. I'm not cry. Well, maybe I'm a little bit of a crier, but...
I am, too. you know, the way you talk about him, and I have wondered, has there been some moment during this campaign where you wish you could have talked to him?
Every moment. And I'd say most especially, you are going to make me cry, because my father... Wow. My father worked at BU and he died at BU. And so I feel especially close to him. I did my makeup for this. Are you kidding me?
I'm sorry.
Someone get me a tissue.
Actually, could someone get her a tissue, please?
And I think that, so when I'm at BU, when I'm around BU, I feel especially close to him. And actually, the day I announced my candidacy, because I think about him quite a bit, the day I announced my candidacy, there was a few of us in the car, and we were doing a whole bunch of, thank you, Karen.
Perfect.
We were doing a whole bunch of, look at this, look at it, in case I keep crying. I forgot to put that spray afterwards on my makeup so it wouldn't run all over my face.
It
anyone,
is not running.
If there's ugly crying, my friends in the audience, you got to let me know. We're going to have problems.
It's not running.
So when I, thank you. Yeah. So when I, listen, the people of Boston, you're going to get it all. You're going to get it all. The good, the bad, and the ugly crying. So after the announcement, I actually came here. I said, I want to come to BU because this was the last place that he was alive. And although I feel him with me every day, and I have a pendant with his picture. Anyway, so he, I think of him often, and I actually talk about him out loud often, because we had a complicated, I'm the oldest Arab daughter to an Arab Muslim man, and I was raised Catholic. So we had a lot of conflict over the years. And he pushed me, he inspired me, he made me crazy, but he motivated me sometimes in like sort of a roundabout way. He told me I couldn't be mayor, and I said, I'm going to show you. And I'm 47 years old, and I still think about my 15, 16-year-old self. I'm an adult with lots of accomplishments to run on, but I think about my father. I say he would have been my biggest cheerleader and also my probably one of my most thoughtful critics over the course of this campaign. He would have knocked more doors. He would have made more phone calls. He would have worked his tail off until... The polls close at that exact moment, and I know that there are, and I meet people actually frequently enough that would say, oh man, your father, he would have been a machine over the course of this campaign. I actually received an email early in the campaign after one of my whatever appearances somewhere from a student who knew him and said, oh, please send your father my regards. We used to talk, he was an Italian student, foreign student. And he goes, we would talk about the soccer matches and that sort of stuff. And I love that. That I love. So anyone watching that knew my father, please send me a message, something good about him. Don't tell me he busted you in a dorm party or something like that. So I think that I try to internalize his strength along the way. He came from a place, Tunisia, lived a very different life than we do here in the United States, had very different experiences, left home. He's one of 17 children, grew up in a very traditional Arab village. My grandfather was the sheikh of Jalma, which is the place where my dad grew up. There is a female mayor of Tunis, the capital of Tunisia, and it was a big, this is a good story. They couldn't figure out what to call her because it was the first time they had elected a female, and I met her. It was the first time they elected a female mayor of Tunis, the capital city. They didn't know what to call her, and they're like, I don't know, Sheikha? And like, that was like, and they figured it out. And she is the sheikh of the Medina. She is the mayor of the capital city. And they've worked it out. Like, we'll be fine, Boston. Everyone's heads are exploding that we'll be fine. Anyway, so I really, you've got me all up in knots here.
So I'm going to ask you one more. I'm going to ask you one more, and then we'll go into some issues too. So identity is huge,
yes,
again, in this campaign. And you've taken all kinds of pushback on identity. You've taken pushback from people on self-identifying.
Pushback is kind.
As a woman of color.
Pushback is a kind way to describe it.
So I want to ask about that, because I want to ask you what it is like to have someone else adjudicate your identity. And were you expecting this? And how have you taken care of yourself
during it?
Well, I've had a good cry here with all of you. That's So lots of people and lots of powers have inserted themselves in this conversation about who I am, what I'm supposed to identify as. In fact, they've said what I should sound like throughout the course of this campaign. And it has been frustrating. It has been maddening. It has been hurtful. It has also been, in many ways, motivating and there's another word I want to use, but, you know, Arabs, so we talk about racial identity. Arabs have never counted, and that has been a difficult thing for my father in particular.
What do you mean by that, never counted?
Well, there's no box for us to check. So, and the BUR did a big story today. You can go read it. It's actually, I think, pretty well written. And Soraya spent a lot of time talking to me about that, talking to me about my father in particular, my story, his story.
That one was actually GBH.
Sorry.
But Anthony corrected one on you
corrected.
Today, too.
Fact check. That can go out in the tweet. Thank you. No. All right. Thank you.
You're
so,
welcome.
Yes. Well, whatever. There's a couple of stories out there. There's a
two
few more.
Today.
Thank you. So, you know, Arabs as a community have always been sort of in this no man's land, or shall I say nomad's land, as we try to find our place in the world. And a lot of that relates to where in the world you've come from, whether it's North Africa in particular or the Middle East in particular. It also is tied to your religious beliefs and which religion you are. And it also ties to, I think, whether or not you wear a head cover as a female or dress in religious or cultural clothing. I think that has an impact on it as well. And I have had an absolute privilege in the way that I present that I get to exist in lots of different rooms and lots of different cultural rooms. I can hang out in white rooms. I can hang out in Arab rooms. I can hang out in black rooms. I can hang out in Latino rooms. There are lots of places in which I can exist. The struggle I have had is in each and every one of those rooms, including the Arab rooms, especially as a non-Muslim and a non-Arab speaker, that I don't always have a seat at the table. And I struggle with that. And that's a personal struggle for me, recognizing and appreciating that how I present also creates a great deal of privilege for me. And I'll never deny that privilege. When I joined the city council in 2016, I was invited to the Electeds of Color meeting. And I finally felt, wow, like I'm going to be in a room with people who feel sometimes like me, set aside, not fully counting, not fully represented, not fully able to engage in the conversation. And I was grateful for that opportunity. And it was just, I went to the meetings, I engaged, I do a great deal of work, especially when I think about our communities of color, when I think about vulnerable populations, when I think about our schools, especially because our schools have impacted in such a negative way so many of our kids of color across our city, that I really have played a critical role in improving the opportunities for our families of color across the city. And so now I'm running for mayor, and there's this conversation. And it becomes frustrating at times because I really want to just do this work. And I've been criticized for not sharing publicly more of my personal story, more of my family's struggles, both mine personally and then my family's as a whole. But I also feel that the people of Boston who are suffering, who are struggling, who need services, who need government to act, who need their elected officials to engage in the work, deserve that. And it's not for me to reflect on my own story, although I appreciate how important that can be to the work, that I need to do the work. The part that's been even more hurtful than that conversation, because that's always been a part of my life, you know, on applications. And I know my teacher application came out this week around, oh, will you check the white box? Well, my mother is white. There is no Arab box, and I'm not black. And African-American as a box is designated for black Americans. And I know that. And oftentimes, many applications would say African-American of non-Arab descent. And so this year, or last year now, I was grateful to engage with the Arab American Institute in some of their national efforts around getting a box on the census so that Arabs could be counted. And then with even within the Arab community, there's such diversity. But that's a different conversation, and there's some conflict around pan-Arabism versus being a Tunisian or a Moroccan or a Libyan, or, you know, throughout the rest of the region. The part that has been especially frustrating, especially in the last few weeks, was following a New York Times article, sort of having a little bit of fun with my Boston accent, which I'm very proud of. There was an article, an opinion piece in the Globe, which, in to simplify it, called me a racist because I speak with a Boston accent. And I found that hateful, frustrating, ignorant, hurtful. And I say hurtful twice on purpose because it was very hurtful. That is, my father was an immigrant, and I think about my father, and I'm sure my mother came here so young. I'm sure it was also her experience and my grandparents' experience. But my father came here as a young man, spoke very little English. My mother happened to speak French. That's how they communicated, and had a heavy, heavy accent. And I know, as a convenience store worker, as a taxi cab driver, as a hotel worker, that he was mocked for his accent, that he was told to go home because of his accent, that he was called a towel head because of his accent, that he was called a terrorist because of his accent. And then to have the Globe, a major Boston newspaper, come after me personally because I speak with and am proud of my Boston accent made me absolutely bananas. And my team will say, Anissa, don't let them know they got under your skin. That got under my goddamn skin because I, thank you. We wouldn't accept any media fat shaming me. We wouldn't accept any media poking fun on, but that is part of me. And yes, in my victory speech, I had a crowd on election night, a crowd of hundreds of people. And we had so much fun with that damn commercial. It was fun. And to turn something that was fun into something nasty was hurtful. It was not unnecessary, is too light of a word to use. I think it was, I have nothing else to say about it.
Boston City Councilor and mayoral candidate Anissa Saibi George there speaking at a live WBUR City Space town hall last night. That is just an excerpt of the full hour conversation, and she did have more to say about the issue, including what she would say to somebody who might think that her accent means they could be less considered under her leadership. I asked her that, and about a variety of issues, and you can hear the full conversation on our website, radioboston.org, alongside our Monday conversation with her challenger, Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu. That is our show, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beeland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director, our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening this week. Thanks for calling. Have a great weekend. And then join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.